sickness in Bunny. Her dead parents' genes on some Roman Polanski shit. Like the older sister she had never met, Belly was transformed almost overnight into an underage stunner. And if Trujillo had not been on his last directions, he probably would have gunned for her, like he'd been rumored to have gunned for her poor dead sister. For the record, that summer our girl caught a cuerpazo so berserk that only a pornographer or a comic book artist could have designed it with a clear conscience. Every neighborhood has its tetua, but Belly could have put them all to shame. She was la tetua suprema. Her tetas were globes so implausibly titanic they made generous souls pity their bearer and drove every straight male in their vicinity to reevaluate his sorry life. She had the breasts of Luba, 35DDD. And what about that supersonic culo that would tear words right out of niggers' mouths, pull windows from out their motherfucking frames? El culo que jalaba más que una junta de buey. Dios mío. Even your humble watcher, reviewing her old pictures, is struck by what a fucking babe she was. My shout out to Jack Kirby aside, it's hard as a third worlder not to feel a certain amount of affinity for Uatu the Watcher. He resides in the hidden blue area of the moon, and we dark zoners reside, to quote Lisson, on la face cachée de la terre, Earth's hidden face.
¡Anda el diablo! La Inca exclaimed.
¡Hija! What in the world are you eating?
If Belly had been a normal girl, being the neighborhood's most prominent tetua, might have pushed her into shyness, might even have depressed the shit out of her. And at first, Belly had both these reactions, and also the feeling that gets delivered to you by the bucket for free during adolescence.
Shame, sharam, vergüenza.
She no longer wanted to bathe with La Inca, a huge change in their morning routine.
Well, I guess you're grown enough to wash yourself, La Inca said lightly.
But you could tell she was hurt. In the close darkness of their wash closet, Belly circled disconsolately around her Novi Orbis, avoiding her hypersensitive nipples at all costs. Now every time she had to head outside, Belly felt like she was stepping into a danger room filled with men's laser eyes and women's razor whispers. The blasts of car horns enough to make her fall over herself. She was furious at the world for this newly acquired burden, and furious at herself. For the first month, that is. Gradually, Belly began to see beyond the catcalls and the Dios mío asesina, and the
¿Y esa teta torillo?
And the ¿Qué pechonalidad? To the hidden mechanisms that drove these comments. One day on the way back from the bakery, La Inca muttering at her side about that day's receipts, it dawned on Belly.
Men liked her.
Not only did they like her, they liked her a fucking lot. The proof was the day that one of their customers, the local dentist, slipped her a note with his money, and it said, I want to see you. As simple as that. Belly was terrified, scandalized, and giddy. The dentist had a fat wife who ordered a cake from La Inca almost every month, either for one of her 7 children or for her 50-some cousins, but most likely for her and her alone. She had a waddle and an enormous middle-aged ass that challenged all chairs. Belly mooned over that note like it was a marriage proposal from God's hot sun, even though the dentist was bald and paunchier than an OTB regular and had a tracery of fine red veins all over his cheeks. The dentist came in as he always did, but now his eyes were always questing.
Hello, Señorita Belly.
His greeting now fetid with lust and threat, and Belly's heart would beat like nothing she'd ever heard. After 2 such visits, she wrote on a whim a little note that said simply,
Yes, you can pick me up at the park at tal and tal time, and passed it back to him with his change, and by hook and crook,
arranged to be walking with La Inca through the park at the very moment of the assignation. Her heart going like crazy. She didn't know what to expect, but she had a wild hope. And just as they were about to leave the park, Belly spotted the dentist sitting in a car that was not his, pretending to read the paper but looking forlornly in her direction.
"Look, madre," Belly said loudly. "It's the dentist."
And La Inca turned, and homeboy threw the car frantically into gear and tore out of there before La Inca could even wave.
"How very strange," La Inca said.
"I don't like him," Belly said. "He looks at me."
And now it was his wife who came to the bakery to pick up the cakes.
"Y el dentista?"
Belly inquired innocently.
"That one's too lazy to do anything," his wife said, with no little exasperation.
Belly, who'd been waiting for something exactly like her body her whole life, was sent over the moon by what she now knew. By the undeniable concreteness of her desirability, which was, in its own way, power. Like the accidental discovery of the One Ring. Like stumbling into the wizard Shazam's cave, or finding the crashed ship of the Green Lantern. Hipatia Belicia Cabral finally had power and a true sense of self. Started pinching her shoulders back, wearing the tightest clothes she had.
"Dios mío," La Inca said every time the girl headed out. "Why would God give you that burden in this country of all places?"
Telling Belly not to flaunt those curves would have been like asking the persecuted fat kid not to use his recently discovered mutant abilities. With great power comes great responsibility. Bullshit. Our girl ran into the future that her new body represented and never ever looked back. Hunt the Light Knight. Now fully endowed, Belly returned to El Redentor from summer break to the alarm of faculty and students alike and set out to track down Jack Pujols with the great deliberation of Ahab after you-know-who. And of all these things, the albino boy was the symbol. Wonder ye then at the fiery hunt. Another girl would have been more subtle, drawn her prey to her. But what did Belly know about process or patience? She threw everything she had at Jack, batted her eyes so much at him that she almost sprained her eyelids, put her tremendous chest in his line of sight every chance she got. Adopted a walk that got her yelled at by the teachers, but that brought the boys and the male faculty a-running. But Pujols was unmoved, observed her with his deep dolphin eyes and did nothing. After about a week of this, Belly was going out of her mind. She had expected him to fall instantly. And so, one day, out of shameless desperation, she pretended to accidentally leave buttons on her blouse open. She was wearing this lacy bra she stole from Dorca, who had acquired quite a nice chest herself. But before Belly could bring her colossal cleavage to bear, her very own wave motion gun, Way, blushing deeply, ran over and buttoned her up.
"You showing?"
Jack drifting disinterestedly away. She tried everything but no dice. Before you know it, Belly was back to banging into him in the hall.
"Cabral," he said with a smile, "you have to be more careful."
"I love you," she wanted to scream.
"I want to have all your children. I want to be your woman."
But instead she said,
"You be careful."
She was morose. September ended, and, alarmingly enough, she had her best month at the school. Academically. English was her number one subject, how ironic. She learned the names of the 50 states. She could ask for coffee, a bathroom, the time, where the post office was. Her English teacher, a deviant, assured her that her accent was superb, superb. The other girls allowed him to touch them. But Belly, now finally attuned to masculine weirdness, and certain that she was worthy only of a prince, sidled out from under his balmy hands. A teacher asked them to start thinking about the new decade. Where would you like to see yourself, your country, and our glorious president in the coming years? No one understood the question, so he had to break it down into two simple parts. One of her classmates, Mauricio Ledesma, got in serious trouble, so bad that his family had to spirit him out of the country. He was a quiet boy who sat next to one of the squadron, stewing always in his love for her. Perhaps he thought he'd impress her. Not that far-fetched, for soon comes the generation whose number one ass-getting technique will not be to be like Mike, but to be like Che. Perhaps he'd just had enough. He wrote in the crabbed handwriting of a future poet revolutionary, "I'd like to see our country be a democracia like the United States. I wish we would stop having dictators. Also, I believe that it was Trujillo who killed Galíndez." Much in the news in those days, Jesús de Galíndez was a Basque super nerd and a Columbia University grad student who had written a rather unsettling doctoral dissertation. The topic? Lamentably, unfortunately, sadly, the era of Rafael Leónidas Trujillo Molina. Galíndez, a loyalist in the Spanish Civil War, had first-hand knowledge of the regime. He had taken refuge in Santo Domingo in 1939, occupied high positions therein, and by his departure in 1946 had developed a lethal allergy to the failed cattle thief. Could conceive for himself no higher duty than to expose the blight that was his regime. Crassweller describes Galíndez as a bookish man, a type frequently found among political activists in Latin America, the winner of a prize in poetry, what we in the higher planes call a nerd class two. But dude was a ferocious leftist, despite the dangers, gallantly toiling on his Trujillo dissertation. What is it with dictators and writers anyway? Since before the infamous Caesar-Ovid War, they've had beef. Like the Fantastic Four in Galactus. Like the X-Men and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Like the Teen Titans and Deathstroke. Foreman and Ali. Morrison and Crouch. Sammy and Sergio. They seemed destined to be eternally linked in the halls of battle. Rushdie claims that tyrants and scribblers are natural antagonists, but I think that's too simple. It lets writers off pretty easy. Dictators, in my opinion, just know competition when they see it. Same with writers. Like, after all, recognizes like. Long story short, upon learning of the dissertation, El Jefe first tried to buy the thing, and when that failed, he dispatched his chief Nazgul, the sepulchral Félix Bernardino, to NYC, and within days Galíndez got gagged, bagged, and dragged to La Capital. And legend has it when he came out of his chloroform nap, he found himself naked, dangling from his feet over a cauldron of boiling oil, El Jefe standing nearby with a copy of the offending dissertation in hand. And you thought your committee was rough. Who in his right mind could ever have imagined anything so fucking ghastly? I guess El Jefe wanted to host a little tertulia with that poor doomed nerd. And what a tertulia it was, Dios mío. Anyway, Galíndez's disappearance caused an uproar in the States, with all fingers pointing to Trujillo. But of course he swore his innocence. And that was what Mauricio was referring to. But take heart. For every phalanx of nerds who die, there are always a few who succeed. Not long after that horrific murder, a whole pack of revolutionary nerds ran aground on a sandbar on the southeast coast of Cuba. Yes, it was Fidel. And revolutionary crew back for a rematch against Batista. Of the 82 revolutionaries who splashed ashore, only 22 survived to celebrate the new year, including one book-loving Argentino. A bloodbath, with Batista's forces executing even those who surrendered. But these 22, it would prove, were enough. The next day, both Mauricio Ledesma and the teacher were gone. No one saying nothing. Belli's essay was far less controversial.
I will be married to a handsome, wealthy man. I will also be a doctor with my own hospital that I will name after Trujillo.
At home, she continued to brag to Dorca about her boyfriend. And when Jack Pujols's photo appeared in the school newspaper, she brought it home in triumph. Dorca was so overwhelmed, she spent the night in her house, inconsolable, crying and crying. Belli could hear her loud and clear. And then, in the first days of October, as the Puebla was getting ready to celebrate another Trujillo birthday, Belli heard a whisper that Jack Pujols had broken up with his girlfriend. Belli had always known about this girlfriend, who attended another school, but do you think she cared? She was sure it was just a rumor, didn't need any more hope to torture her. But it turned out to be more than a rumor, and more than hope, because not 2 days later, Jack Pujols stopped Belli in the hallway as though he were seeing her for the very first time.
Cabral, he whispered, you're beautiful.
The sharp spice of his cologne like an intoxication.
I know I am, she said, her face ablaze with heat.
Well, he said, burying a mitten his perfectly straight hair. The next thing you know, he was giving her rides in his brand new Mercedes and buying her helados with the knot of dollars he carried in his pocket. Legally, he was too young to drive, but do you think anybody in Santo Domingo stopped a colonel's son for anything? Especially the son of a colonel who was said to be one of Ramfis Trujillo's confidants. By Ramfis Trujillo, I mean, of course, Rafael Leonidas Trujillo Martinez, el jefe's first son, born while his mother was still married to another man, un cubano. It was only after the cubano refused to accept the boy as blood that Trujillo recognized Ramfis as his own. Thanks, Dad. He was the famous son that el jefe made a colonel at the age of 4 and a brigadier general at the age of 9. Little fuckface, as he is affectionately known. As an adult, Ramfis was famed for being a polo player, a fucker of North American actresses, Kim Novak, how could you, a squabbler with his father, and a frozen-hearted demon with a humanity rating of 0, who personally directed the indiscriminate torture murders of 1959, the year of the Cuban invasion, and 1961. After his father was assassinated, Ramfis personally saw to the horror torture of the conspirators. In a secret report filed by the U.S. consul, currently available at the JFK Presidential Library, Ramfis is described as imbalanced, a young man who, during his childhood, amused himself by blowing the heads off chickens with a .44 revolver. Ramfis fled the country after Trujillo's death, lived dissolutely off his father's swag, and ended up dying in a car crash of his own devising in 1969. The other car he hit contained the Duchess of Albuquerque, Teresa Beltrán de Lis, who died instantly. Little fuckface went on murdering right to the end.
Amor.
It wasn't quite the romance she would later make it out to be. A couple of talks, a walk on the beach while the rest of the class was having a picnic, and before she knew it, she was sneaking into a closet with him after school, and he was slipping it to her something terrible. Let's just say that she finally understood why the other boys had given him the nickname Jack the Ripio. He had what even she knew to be an enormous penis, a Shiva-sized lingam, a destroyer of worlds. And the whole time she'd thought they'd been calling him Jack the Ripper. Duh. Later, after she'd been with the gangster, she would realize how little respect Pujols had for her. But since she had nothing to compare it to at the time, she assumed fucking was supposed to feel like she was being run through with a cutlass. The first time she was scared shitless, and it hurt bad. 4D10. But nothing could obliterate the feeling she had that finally she was on her way. The sense of a journey starting, of a first step taken, of the beginning of something big. Afterward, she tried to embrace him, to touch his silken hair. But he shook off her caresses. "Hurry up and get dressed. If we get caught, my ass will be in the fire." Which was funny because that's exactly how her ass felt. For about a month, they scrumped in various isolated corners of the school until the day a teacher, acting on an anonymous tip from a member of the student body, surprised the undercover couple in flagrante delicto in a broom closet. Just imagine, belly, butt naked, her vast scar like nothing anybody had seen before, and Jack with his pants puddled around his ankle. The scandal. Remember the time and the place. Bonnie in the late '50s. Factor in that Jack Pujols was the number one son of one of Bonnie's most venerable and filthy rich families. Factor in that he'd been caught not with one of his own class, though that might have also been a problem, but with the scholarship girl, una prieta to boot. The fucking of poor prietas was considered standard operating procedure for elites just as long as it was kept on the dolo, what is elsewhere called the Strom Thurmond maneuver. Pujols, of course, blamed Belly for everything. Sat in the office of the rector and explained in great detail how she had seduced him. "It wasn't me," he insisted. "It was her." The real scandal, however, was that Pujols was actually engaged to that girlfriend of his, the half-in-the-grave Rebecca Brito, herself a member of Bani's other powerful family. And you better believe Jack getting caught in a closet with una prieta kebabbed any future promise of matrimony. Her family, very particular about their Christian reputation. Pujols's old man was so infuriated, humiliated, that he started beating the boy as soon as he laid hands on him and within the week had shipped him off to a military school in Puerto Rico, where he would, in the colonel's words, learn the meaning of duty. Belly never saw him again, except once in the Listín Diario, and by then they were both in their 40s. Pujols might have been a bitch-ass rat, but Belly's reaction was one for the history books. Not only was our girl not embarrassed by what had happened, even after being shaken down by the rector and the nun and the janitor, a holy triple team, she absolutely refused to profess her guilt. If she had rotated her head around 360 degrees and vomited green pea soup, it would have caused only slightly less of an uproar. In typical hard-headed Belly fashion, our girl insisted that she'd done nothing wrong, that in fact she was well within her rights. "I'm allowed to do anything I want," Belly said stubbornly, "with my husband." Pujols, it seems, had promised Belicia that they would be married as soon as they'd both finished high school, and Belly had believed him hook, line, and sinker. Hard to square her credulity with the hard-nosed, no-nonsense femme matador I'd come to know. But one must remember, she was young and in love. Talk about fantasist. The girl sincerely believed that Jack would be true. The good teachers of El Redentor never squeezed anything close to a mea culpa from the girl. She kept shaking her head, as stubborn as the laws of the universe themselves. "No, no, 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 no." Not that it mattered in the end. Belicia's tenure at the school was over, and so were La Inca's dreams of recreating, in Belly, her father's genius, his magis, his excellence in all things. In any other family, such a thing would have meant the beating of Belly to within an inch of her life, beating her straight into the hospital with no delay, and then, once she was better, beating her again and putting her back into the hospital. But La Inca was not that kind of parent.
La Inca, you see, was a serious woman, an upstanding woman, one of the best of her class. But she was incapable of punishing the girl physically. Call it a hitch in the universe, call it mental illness, but La Inca just couldn't do it. Not then, not ever. All she could do was wave her arms in the air and hurl laments. How could this have happened? La Inca demanded. How? How? He was going to marry me, Belly cried. We were going to have children.
Are you insane?
La Inca roared.
Hija, have you lost your mind?
Took a while for shit to calm down. The neighbors loving the whole thing.
I told you that Blackie was good for nothing.
But eventually things did, and only then did La Inca convoke a special session on our girl's future. First, La Inca gave Belly tongue-lashing number 500,000,005, exoriating her poor judgment, her poor morals, her poor everything. And only when those preliminaries were good and settled did La Inca lay down the law. You are returning to school, not to El Redentor, but somewhere nearly as good. Padre Bilini. And Belly, her eyes still swollen from Jack loss, laughed.
I'm not going back to school. Not ever.
Had she forgotten the suffering that she had endured in her lost years in the pursuit of education? The costs? The terrible scars on her back? The burning? Perhaps she had. Perhaps the prerogatives of this new age had rendered the vows of the old irrelevant. However, during those tumultuous post-expulsion weeks, while she'd been writhing in her bed over the loss of her husband, our girl had been rocked by instances of stupendous turbidity. A first lesson in the fragility of love and the preternatural cowardice of men. And out of this disillusionment and turmoil sprang Belly's first adult oath. One that would follow her into adulthood to the States and beyond. I will not serve. Never again would she follow any lead other than her own. Not the rector's, not the nuns, not La Inca's, not her poor dead parents. Only me, she whispered. Me. This oath did much to rally her. Not long after the back-to-school showdown, Belly put on one of La Inca's dresses, was literally bursting in it, and caught a ride down to the Parque Central. This was not a huge trip, but still, for a girl like Belly, it was a precursor of things to come. When she returned to the house in the late afternoon, she announced, I have a job! La Inca snorted. I guess the cabarets are always hiring. It was not a cabaret. Belly might have been a puta major in the cosmology of her neighbors, but a cuero she was not. No. She had landed a job as a waitress at a restaurant on the parque. The owner, a stout, well-dressed Chinese by the name of Juan Ten, had not exactly needed anyone. In fact, he didn't know if he needed himself. Business terrible, he lamented. Too much politics. Politics bad for everything but politicians. No excess money. And already many impossible employees. But Belly was not willing to be rejected. There's a lot I can do. And pinched her shoulder blades to emphasize her assets. Which for a man any less righteous would have been an open invitation, but Juan simply sighed. No obligated be without shame. We try you up. Probationary period. Can't promises built. Political conditions give promises no hospitality. What's my salary?
Salary? No salary. You a waitress. You tips.
How much are they? Once again the glumness.
It is without certainty.
I don't understand. His brother Jose's bloodshot eyes glanced up from the sports section.
What my brother is saying is that it all depends. And here's La Inca shaking her head.
A waitress? But hija, you're a baker's daughter. You don't know the first thing about waitressing.
La Inca assumed that because Belly had of late not shown any enthusiasm for the bakery or school or for cleaning, she'd devolved into a sangana. But she'd forgotten that our girl had been a criada in her first life. For half her years, she'd known nothing but work. La Inca predicted that Belly would call it quits within a couple of months, but Belly never did. On the job, our girl, in fact, showed her quality. She was never late, never malingered, worked her sizable ass off. Heck, she liked the job. It was not exactly President of the Republic, but for a 14-year-old who wanted out of the house, it paid, and kept her in the world while she waited for her glorious future to materialize. 18 months she worked at the Palacio Peking. She would always say she came of age in the restaurant, and in some way she did. She learned to beat men at dominoes and proved herself so responsible that the Brothers Ten could leave her in charge of the cook and the other waitstaff while they slipped out to fish and visit their thick-legged girlfriends. In later years, Belly would lament that she had ever lost touch with her chinos.
They were so good to me, she moaned to Oscar and Lola.
Nothing like your worthless esponja of a father.
Juan, the melancholic gambler, who waxed about Shanghai as though it were a love poem sung by a beautiful woman you love but cannot have. Juan, the short-sighted romantic, whose girlfriends robbed him blind and who never mastered Spanish, though in later years, when he was living in Skokie, Illinois, he would yell at his Americanized grandchildren in his guttural Spanish, and they laughed at him, thinking it Chinese. Juan, who taught Belly how to play dominoes, and whose only fundamentalism was his bulletproof optimism.
If only Admiral come to our restaurant first, imagine the trouble that could be avoided.
Sweating gentle Juan, who would have lost the restaurant if not for his older brother. Jose, the enigmatic, who hovered at the periphery with all the menace of a ciclón. Jose the Bravo, the Guapo, his wife and children dead by warlord in the 30s. Jose, who protected the restaurant and the rooms above with an implacable ferocity. Jose, whose grief had extracted from his body all softness, idle chatter, and hope. He never seemed to approve of Belly, or any of the other employees, but since she alone wasn't scared of him, I'm almost as tall as you are. He reciprocated by giving her practical instructions.
You want to be a useless woman all your life? Like how to hammer nails, fix electrical outlets, cook chow fun, and drive a car. All would come in good use when she became the Empress of Diaspora.
Jose would acquit himself bravely in the revolution, fighting, I must regretfully report, against the pueblo, and would die in 1976 in Atlanta, cancer of the pancreas, crying out his wife's name, which the nurses confused for more Chinese gobbledygook, extra emphasis in their minds on the gook. And then there was Lillian, the other waitress, a squat rice tub, whose rancor against the world turned to glee only when humanity exceeded in its venality, brutality, and mendacity even her own expectations. She didn't take to Belly at first, thought her competition, but eventually would treat Belly, more or less, with courtesy. She was the first woman our girl met who read the paper. Belly's son's bibliomania would remind her always of Lillian. How's the world keeping? Belly asked her.
Jodido, was always her answer.
And Indian Benny, a quiet, meticulous waiter who had the sad airs of a man long accustomed to the spectacular demolition of dreams. Rumor at the restaurant had it that Indian Benny was married to a huge, lusty Aswana, who regularly put him on the street so that she could bunk some new sweetmeat. The only time Indian Benny was known to smile was when he beat Jose at dominoes. The two were consummate tile slingers, and of course, bitter rivals. He too would fight in the revolution for the home team. And it was said that throughout that summer of our national liberation, Indian Benny never stopped smiling. Even after a Marine sniper cavitated his brains over his entire command, he didn't stop. And what about the cook, Marco Antonio? A one-legged, no-ear grotesque, straight out of Gormenghast. His explanation for his appearance, I had an accident. His bag was an almost fanatical distrust of Cibaeños, whose regional pride, he was convinced, masked imperial ambitions on a Haitian level.
They want to seize the Republic. I'm telling you, Cristiano, they want to start their own country.
The whole day she dealt with hombres of all stripes, and it was here Belly perfected her rough-spun, salt-of-the-earth bonhomie. As you might imagine, everybody was in love with her, including her co-workers. But Jose had warned them off.
Touch her and I'll pull your guts out your culo.
You must be joking, Marco Antonio said in his own defense. I couldn't climb that mountain even with two legs.
The customer's attention was exhilarating, and she in turn gave the boys something that most men can never get enough of. Ribbing solicitous mothering from an attractive woman. Still plenty of niggers in Bani, old customers who remember her with great fondness.
End of disc 3.
La Inca, of course, was anguished by Belly's fall from Princesa to Mesera.
What is happening to the world?
At home, the two rarely spoke anymore. La Inca tried to talk, but Belly wouldn't listen. And for her part, La Inca filled that silence with prayer, trying to summon a miracle that would transform Belly back into a dutiful daughter. As fate would have it, once Belly had slipped her grasp, not even God had enough caracaracol to bring her back. Every now and then La Inca would appear at the restaurant. She'd sit alone, erect as a lectern, all in black, and between sips of tea would watch the girl with a mournful intensity. Perhaps she hoped to shame Belly into returning to Operation Restore House of Cabral, but Belly went about her work with her customary zeal. It must have dismayed La Inca to see how drastically her daughter was changing. For Belly, the girl who never used to speak in public, who could be still as no, displayed at Palacio Peking a raconteur's gift for palaver, that delighted a great many of the all-male clientele. Those of you who have stood at the corner of 142nd and Broadway can guess what it was she spoke. The blunt, irreverent cant of the pueblo that gives all Dominicanos cultos nightmares on the 400 thread-count sheets, and that La Inca had assumed had perished along with Belly's first life in Outer Asua. But here it was so alive. It was like it had never left.
Oye, pariguayo, ¿y qué pasó con esa esposa tuya? Gordo, no me digas que tú todavía tienes hambre.
Eventually there came a moment when she'd pause at La Inca's table.
Do you want anything else?
Only that you would return to school, mija.
Sorry.
Belly picked up her taza and wiped the table in one perfunctory motion.
We stopped serving pendejada last week.
And then La Inca paid her quarter and was gone, and a great weight lifted off Belly, proof that she'd done the right thing. In those 18 months, she learned a great deal about herself. She learned that, despite all her dreams to be the most beautiful woman in the world, to have the brothers jumping out of windows in her wake, when Belicia Cabral fell in love, she stayed in love. Despite the trove of men, handsome, plain, and ugly, who marched into the restaurant intent on winning her hand in marriage, or at least in fuckage, she never had a thought for anyone but Jack Pujols. Turns out that in her heart, our girl was more Penelope than Whore of Babylon.
Of course, La Inca, who witnessed the parade of men muddying her doorstep, would not have agreed.
Belly often had dreams where Jack returned from military school. Dreams where he'd be waiting for her at the job, spilled out at one of the tables like a beautiful bag of swag. A grin on his magnificent face. His eyes of Atlantis on her at last. Only on her. I came back for you, mi amor. I came back.
Our girl learned that even to a chooch like Jack Pujols, she was true. But that didn't mean she reclused herself entirely from the world of men. For all her fidelity, she would never be a sister who liked being without male attention. Even in this rough period, Belly had her princes in waiting. Brothers willing to brave the barbed-wired minefields of her affections in the hopes that beyond that cruel midden, Elysium might await. The poor deluded chumps. The gangster would have her every which way, but these poor sapos who came before the gangster, they were lucky to get an abrazo. Let us summon back from the abyss two sapos in particular. The Fiat dealer, bald, white, and smiling, a regular Hipólito Mejía, but suave and cavalier and so enamored of North American baseball that he risked life and limb to listen to games on a contraband shortwave radio. He believed in baseball with the fervor of an adolescent and believed also that in the future, Dominicans would storm the major leagues and compete with the Mantles and the Marises of the world. Marichal is only the beginning, he predicted, of a reconquista.
You're crazy, Belly said, mocking him and his jueguito.
In an inspired stroke of counter-programming, her other paramour was a student at the UASD, one of those city college types who's been in school 11 years and is always 5 credits shy of a degree. Student today don't mean nah, but in a Latin America whipped into a frenzy by the fall of Arbenz, by the stoning of Nixon, by the guerrillas of the Sierra Madre, by the endless cynical maneuverings of the Yankee pig dogs, in a Latin America already a year and a half into the decade of the guerrilla, a student was something else altogether. An agent for change. A vibrating quantum string in the staid Newtonian universe. Such a student was Archimedes. He also listened to the shortwave, but not for Dodger scores. What he risked his life for was the news leaking out of Havana, news of the future. Archimedes was, therefore, a student, the son of a zapatero and a midwife, a tirapiedra and a quemagoma for life. Being a student wasn't a joke, not with Trujillo and Johnny Aves scooping up everybody following the foiled Cuban invasion of 1959. Johnny Aves Garcia was one of Trujillo's beloved Morgul lords, chief of the dreaded and all-powerful secret police, SIM. Aves was considered the greatest torturer of the Dominican people ever to have lived. An enthusiast of Chinese torture techniques, Aves was rumored to have in his employ a dwarf who would crush prisoners' testicles between his teeth. Plotted endlessly against Trujillo's enemies, the killer of many young revolutionaries and students, including the Maribao sisters. At Trujillo's behest, Aves organized the plot to assassinate the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Rómulo Betancourt. Betancourt and Tizillo were old enemies, beefing since the 40s, when Trujillo's simians tried to inject Betancourt with poison on the streets of Havana. The second attempt worked no better than the first. The bomb, packed into a green Olds, blew the presidential Cadillac clean out of Caracas, slew the driver and a bystander, but failed to kill Betancourt. Now that's really gangster. Venezolanos, don't ever say we don't have history together. It's not just the novelas that we share, or the fact that so many of us flooded your shores to work in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Our dictator tried to slay your president. After Trujillo's death, Aves was named consul to Japan, just to get him out of the country,
and ended up working for that other Caribbean nightmare, the Haitian dictator, François Papa Doc Duvalier. Wasn't nearly as loyal to Papa Doc as he was to Trujillo. After an attempt to double-cross, Papa Doc shot Aves and his family, and then blew their fucking house up. I think P-Daddy knew exactly what kind of creature he was dealing with. No Dominican believes that Aves died in that blast. He is said to still be out there in the world, waiting for the next coming of El Jefe, when he too will rise from the shadow. Wasn't a day that passed that Archimedes's life wasn't in danger. And he had no fixed address, appeared in Belly's day with no warning. Archie, as he was known, had an immaculate head of hair, and Hector Lavoe glasses, and the intensity of a South Beach dietitian. Reviled the North Americans for their silent invasion of the DR, and Dominicans for their annexationist subservience to the North. Guacanagari has cursed us all. That his most beloved ideologues were a couple of Germans who never met a nigger they liked was beside the point. Both of these dudes Belly played hard. Visited them at their digs and at the dealership and dished them their daily recommended allowance of no play. A date couldn't pass without the Fiat dealer begging her for a single grope. "Just let me touch them with the back of my hand," he mewled. But nearly every time, she picked him off in a fielder's choice. Archimedes, when rebuffed, at least showed some class. He didn't pout or mutter. "What the hell am I wasting my money for?" He preferred to stay philosophical. "The revolution is not made in a day," he'd say ruefully, and then kick back and entertain her with stories about dodging the secret police. Even to a chooch like Jacques Pujols, she was true, yes. But eventually, she did get over him. A romantic she was, but not a pendeja. When she finally came to, however, things had turned dicey, to say the least. The country was in an uproar. After the failed invasion of 1959, an underground conspiracy of youth had been uncovered, and everywhere young people were being arrested and tortured and killed. "Politics," Juan spat, staring at all the empty tables. "Politics." Jose didn't offer comment. He simply cleaned his Smith & Wesson in the privacy of his upstairs room. "I don't know if I'll make it out of this one," Archimedes said in a barefaced attempt to catch a pity fuck. "You'll be fine," Belly snorted, pushing off his embrace. She was right in the end. But he was one of the few who made it through with his balls unfried. Archie survives into the present, and when I drive through the capital with my man Pedro, I occasionally spot his grill on campaign posters for one of the radical splinter parties, whose sole platform is to bring electricity back to the Dominican Republic. Pedro snorts, "Ese ladrón no va pa ningún lado." In February, Lillian had to quit the job and return to her campo to care for her ailing mother, a señora who, Lillian claimed, had never given a damn for her well-being. "But it is the fate of women everywhere to be miserable always," Lillian declared. And then she was gone, and only the cheap freebie calendar she liked marking off remained. A week later, the Brothers Ten hired a replacement, a new girl, Constantina. In her 20s, sunny and amiable, whose cuerpo was all pipa and no culo, a mujer alegre, in the parlance of the period. More than once, Constantina arrived to lunch straight from a night of partying, smelling of whiskey and stale cigarettes. "Muchacha, you wouldn't believe el lío en que me metí anoche?" She was disarmingly chill, and could curse the black off a crow, and perhaps, recognizing a kindred spirit alone in the world, took an immediate liking to our girl. "My hermanita," she called Belly, "the most beautiful girl. You're proof that God is Dominican." Constantina was the person who finally pried the sad ballad of Jacques Pujols out of her. Her advice?
Forget that hijo de la porra that come huevo. Every desgraciado who walks in here is in love with you. You could have the whole maldito world if you wanted. The world. It was what she desired with her entire heart. But how could she achieve it? She watched the flow of traffic past the parque and did not know. One day, in a burbuja of girlish impulse, they finished work early and, taking their earnings to the Spaniards down the street, bought a pair of matching dresses. "Now you look candela," Constantina said approvingly. "So what you going to do now?" Belly asked. A crooked tooth smile. "Me? I'm going to the Hollywood for a dance. I have un buen amigo working in the door, and from what I hear, there'll be a whole assembly line of rich men with nothing to do but adore me, I see." She shivered her hands down the slopes of her hips. Then she stopped the show. "Why? Does the private school princess actually want to come along?" Belly thought about it a moment. Thought about La Inca waiting for her at home. Thought about the heartbreak that was beginning to fade in her. "Yes. I want to go." There it was. The decision that changed everything. Or, as she broke it down to Lola in her last days, "All I wanted was to dance. What I got instead was esto," she said, opening her arms to encompass the hospital, her children, her cancer, America. El Hollywood. El Hollywood was Belly's first real club. A favorite hangout of Trujillo's, my mother tells me, when the manuscript is almost complete. Imagínate. In those days, El Hollywood was the it place to be in Baní. It was Alexander, Café Atlántico, and Jet Set rolled into one. The lights, the opulent decor, the guapos and the fine threads, the women striking their best bird-of-paradise poses, the band upon the stage like a visitation from a world of rhythm, the dancers so caught up in the planting of heel, you would have thought they were bidding farewell to death itself. It was all here. Belly might have been out of her league, couldn't order drinks or sit in the high chairs without losing her cheap shoes, but once the music started, well, it didn't matter. A corpulent accountant put his hand out, and for the next 2 hours, Belly forgot her awkwardness, her wonderment, her trepidation, and danced. Dios mío, did she dance! Dancing café out of the sky and exhausting partner after partner. Even the band leader, a salt-and-pepper veterano from a dozen campaigns throughout Latin America and Miami, shouted her out, "La negra está encendida!" La negra está encendida indeed. Here, at last, is her smile. Burn it into your memory. You won't see it often. Everybody mistook her for a bailarina cubana from one of the shows and couldn't believe that she was Dominicana like them. "It can't be. No lo pareces," etc., etc. And it was in this whirligig of pasos, guapos, and aftershave that he appeared. She was at the bar, waiting for Tina to return from a cigarette break. Her dress, wrecked, her perm, kicking, her arches, like they'd been given a starter course in foot binding. He, on the other hand, was the essence of relaxed cool. Here he is, future generation of De Leons and Cabrals, the man who stole your founding mother's heart, who catapulted her and hers into diaspora. Dressed in a rat-pack ensemble of black smoking jacket and white pants and not a dot of sweat on him, like he'd been keeping himself in refrigeration. Handsome in that louche, pot-bellied, mid-40s Hollywood producer sort of way, with pouched gray eyes that had seen and didn't miss much. Eyes that had been scoping Belly for the better part of an hour, and it wasn't like Belly hadn't noticed. The nigger was some kind of baller. Everybody in the club was paying tribute to him, and he rocked enough gold to have ransomed Atahualpa. Let's just say
Their first contact was not promising.
"How about I buy you a drink?"
he said, and when she turned away como una ruda, he grabbed her arm hard and said, "Where are you going, Morena?" And that was all it took.
A Veli le salió el lobo.
First, she didn't like to be touched. Not at all, not ever. Second, she was not a Morena. Even the car dealer knew better, called her India. And third, there was that temper of hers. When Baller twisted her arm, she went from zero to violence in under 0.2 seconds. Shrieked, "No me toques!" Threw her drink, her glass, and then her purse at him. If there had been a baby nearby, she would have thrown that too. Then let him have it with a stack of cocktail napkins and almost 100 plastic olive rapiers. And when those were done dancing on the tile, she unleashed one of the great Street Fighter chain attacks of all time. During this unprecedented fusillade of blows, the gangster hunkered down and didn't move, except to deflect the stray chop away from his face. When she finished, he lifted his head as though out of a foxhole and put a finger to his lips. "You missed a spot," he said solemnly.
"Well."
It was nothing but a simple encounter. The fight she had with La Inca upon her return was far more significant. La Inca waiting up for her with a belt in her hand. And when Belly stepped into the house, worn out from dancing, La Inca lit by the kerosene lamp, lifted the belt in the air, and Belly's diamond eyes locked onto her. The primal scene between daughter and mother played out in every country of the world. "Go ahead, madre," Belly said. But La Inca could not do it, her strength leaving her.
"Hija, if you ever come home late again, you'll have to leave this house."
And Belly saying, "Don't worry, I'll be leaving soon enough." That night, La Inca refused to get into bed with her, sleeping in her rocking chair, not speaking to her the next day either, going off to work by herself, her disappointment looming above her like a mushroom cloud. No question. It was her madre she should have been worried about. But for the rest of that week, Belly found herself instead brooding on the stupidity of that gordo azaroso who, in her words, had ruined her whole night. Almost every day she found herself recounting the details of the confrontation to both the car dealer and Archimedes. But with each telling, she added further outrages, which were not exactly true, but seemed accurate in spirit.
"Un bruto," she called him. "Un animal. How dare he try to touch me? As though he were someone, ese poco hombre, ese mamahuevo."
"So he hit you." The car dealer was trying to pin her hand down to his leg, but failing.
"Maybe that's what I need to do."
"And you'd get exactly what he got," she said.
Archimedes, who'd taken to standing in a closet while she visited him, just in case the secret police burst in, pronounced the gangster a typical bourgeois type, his voice reaching her through all that fabric that the car dealer had bought her, and which Belly stored at his place.
"Is this a mink fur?" he asked her.
"Rabbit," she said morosely.
"I should have stabbed him," she said to Constantina.
"Muchacha,
I think he should have stabbed you."
"What the hell do you mean?"
"I'm just saying, you talk about him a whole lot."
"No,"
she said hotly. "It's not like that at all."
"Then stop talking about him."
Tina glanced down at a pretend watch.
5 seconds.
It must be a record. She tried to keep him out of her mouth, but it was hopeless. Her forearm ached at the oddest of moments, and she could feel his hangdog eyes on her everywhere. The next Friday was a big day at the restaurant. The local chapter of the Dominican Party was having an event, and the staff busted their ass from early to late. Belly, who loved the bustle, showed some of her magas for hard work, and even Jose had to come out of the office to help cook. Jose awarded the head of the chapter with a bottle of what he claimed was Chinese rum, but which in fact was Johnny Walker with the label scraped off. The higher echelons enjoyed their chow fun immensely, but their campo underlings poked at the noodles miserably and asked over and over if there was any arroz con habichuelas, of which of course there was none. All in all, the event was a success. You never would have guessed there was a dirty